Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Hello, welcome to the March 2024 edition of Space Boffins, in partnership with the Naked Scientists and supported by the UK Space Agency. I'm a slightly ill Richard Hollingham.
And I'm a slightly less ill Sue Nelson, and this time we continue our lunar theme. We'll be speaking shortly to the Chief Scientist for Intuitive Machines after their successful moon landing. We'll also hear from one of the ground stations involved in that mission and from the team hoping to build a nuclear power station for the moon.
We hope to have a working prototype and test reactor on Earth in the late 20s and then have one of these reactors on the surface of the moon, powering a moon base in the early 30s.
Well, as you'll know, the Odyssey lander recently became the first US craft to return to the moon's surface since the Apollo missions ended over 50 years ago. I mean, that's pretty awesome when you think about it. Not only that, it was the first commercially built lander too as part of the IM-1 mission. IM standing for Intuitive Machines, based in Houston, Texas. Their chief scientist is Ben Bussey, and he is with us now. But he doesn't have a Houston accent.
He does not. He has a Cornish accent.
How does that go down in Houston?
It's good for customer service calls.
That's excellent. Let's talk about the mission. I mean, what were the highlight for you?
So I have to admit, I'm a lunar scientist by background, and I've always had an interest in space. But I was, even the launch, I was surprised how visceral it felt, because one had been part of the team, and to feel that you'd made a small contribution to make this thing happen. It was surprisingly emotional, I will admit. Both my wife and I were down in Florida for the launch, and it was a night launch just after midnight on a Falcon 9, and it was visually stunning, including the first stage coming back to land. And I had not seen that in person before at night, and it comes down very quickly and lights that engine and lands a few miles away.
And to think you're going to the moon as well, you know, I mean, SpaceX launches are becoming quite routine now, a lot of satellite launches, but this is just going that so much further.
Yeah, I mean, it generally did sort of blow my mind that to be part of going back to the lunar surface. Having looked at pictures of the moon for most of my career, to work on a landed mission was just incredibly exciting. And to see the data on the way and the data from the surface. And from a scientific perspective, it was also exciting what this opens up going forward with, you know, we've demonstrated the capability, the idea that commercial companies can take a wide variety of payloads to the surface. And I'm excited what the future will bring.
Well, before we go to what lies ahead, in terms of the mission, the IM-1, what have you got out of it, apart from the sort of firsts that you've done in terms of being commercial and getting there? What sort of science did you get done on the surface?
We carried 12 payloads. So this mission was part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services, which is often, NASA likes an acronym, so it gets referred to as CLPS. And so we are one of the CLPS providers. And just a little bit of background, the way that works is NASA does a solicitation, or it issues what they call a task order, which essentially says, NASA would like these payloads flown to the lunar surface, please, you know, propose a price. And they've done 8 of these, and we have won 3 of those, and IM-1 was our first. But the goal behind CLPS wasn't just a cheaper way of flying NASA payloads. It was to try and instigate a commercial capability so that other people could get payloads flown to the moon. So IM-1, we had 12 payloads. Six of those were the original NASA CLPS payloads, and six were commercial payloads that we had found ourselves. And we can talk more about those. They were quite an eclectic mix of payloads, the non-NASA ones. So from a science perspective, you know, it's whatever the payloads were. On the NASA side, they were more technology focused. There were a couple of navigation payloads which were testing key technologies. There was an interesting fuel gauge instrument. So obviously in your car, if you know what the petrol level is because gravity very helpfully gives you the level. Once you fly in space, it's not obvious what your fuel level is. And
oh wow, NASA, I had never thought of that.
Yeah, no, do you what? Neither had I. And so there was this radio frequency mass gauge, which essentially put radio waves through the tank and says there's this much liquid in the tank. And so they tested that. Now, there was one, don't get me wrong, it wasn't totally devoid of science. There was a radio science experiment. Four long antennas got deployed, and these took the first radio science measurements from the lunar surface. This was called ROLSIS, another NASA acronym. And the radio science is exciting. Again, the far side of the moon is unique in the solar system in that the Earth is quite a noisy species with all our electronics. And so the far side represents a unique location for radio science where they can take incredibly sensitive measurements, which allows them to look back early into the history of the universe. And so this was a precursor instrument for something I know the radio science community would like to fly to the far side of the moon.
And that's been talked about for many years, hasn't it? A radio telescope on the far side of the moon. I've always imagined an enormous one like the sort of Jodrell Bank,
yes.
Sort of, not a little tiny one on a lander.
You can see artist depictions where they happily use the crater shape, which is sort of like a big dish. But there are also ideas where you essentially just need very long linear antennas. And so you can imagine a scenario where actually a rover just goes from a central point three or four directions one at a time and just deploys these long antenna on the surface. And that's one advantage of the moon is you do have a little bit of gravity to help you set up equipment as opposed to free space.
You mentioned some of the other experiments on there. I mean, you don't have to go through all of them, but are there some that, you know, particularly as you're the scientist here, that, you know, sort of caught your attention or thought there's a lot of potential here for future science?
Yes. I mean, I think the radio science, ROLSIS is probably that is the highest science return. But from the commercial payloads that we flew, there are a couple that aren't science, but I think represent the benefit that I hope we get long term from doing things like CLPS. So one was an art cube. One was Jeff Koons, famous artist, and we flew this cube which consisted of 125 miniature moons, all with a unique phase. And then you know, customers through him they buy. I think it's a bigger one on Earth, but they get to see a picture of their one on the moon. And I found that intriguing because I think, you know, when we look at NASA missions and European Space Agency missions, as you say, we often focus on the science and we love to see humans in space. And hopefully we see humans back on the moon in the next few years. And that will be extremely exciting. But to go into science fiction mode, you know, if 20 years from now we're exploring the moon in the way that I hope we are, then it isn't just going to be science and engineering. It's going to be the whole of humanity taking part. So the fact on our very first mission, we had an art payload, I think is extremely exciting. The other one that if people have seen images of our lander, they'll notice a gold face and Columbia. And so Columbia, the outdoor clothing company, that I want to raise that one because that wasn't just marketing for Columbia as in, hey, here's our logo on the moon. We actually used the same material that they put inside their coats, OmniTech Infinity. This started as a collaboration in that they were really curious to test their, because you know, they have a fleet of scientists who do material science to try and make better outdoor clothing that's lighter and warmer. And they liked the idea of testing that on the moon in an incredibly harsh thermal environment. And equally, we were intrigued about maybe this could be a lighter weight way of doing thermal management of our lander. So that one was actually testing the same equipment you can get in the coats on the lunar surface.
That's interesting. Also, keep that regolith out.
Absolutely. That's dirt get everywhere.
Can I bring you back to science fiction mode? Because I really must ask this question about your control room. Is it really based on the bridge from the Starship Enterprise?
I can't answer that. I will say it looks a bit similar.
Is that for commercial reasons?
For copyright reasons, we can't possibly comment. Yeah. Okay.
Now, I love the fact that, you know, NASA obviously called the mission an unqualified success, which it was. But obviously, you know, like all missions, not everything went as planned. Do you have a full understanding now of why one of those lander legs snapped?
Yes, absolutely. And so the main reason for that is we had a key instrument for the final phase of landing, which is a laser altimeter. And the laser altimeter, just like when the police catch you for speeding, is very good at measuring distance and speed. And so a lander uses a laser altimeter to basically tell the engine, hey, we're coming into landing, and this is when we turn the throttle down and then touch the surface. And unfortunately, we had a problem with the connection with our laser altimeter, which meant that we weren't getting data from it. So we were relying on what they call an inertial unit, which knew where it was in space at a certain time and then tried to measure how much we'd moved. Because of that, the plan was to touch down at a velocity of about 1 meter per second, which is about 2 miles an hour. And we ended up coming down about three times faster. So we came down about 3 meters per second, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, when we'd been traveling, you know,
Yes, exactly, that long distance. Yes.
It's 400,000 kilometers away. It was the last 3 meters that got you. And so because of that, yes, we came down slightly harder. The legs did the job in that they absorbed the shock. As you mentioned, that did cause probably a couple of them to break, but did leave us the main spacecraft intact on the surface, which allowed us to operate and collect data for over 6 days before the sun went down.
And the mission's now at an end. Like you say, the sun went down and that was it. There was never any intention there's no intention of reviving it, or, you know, we've seen other landers sort of come back to life, for example.
Yes. So the answer to that one is, you know, so a typical lunar day is 14 Earth days of sunlight followed by 14 Earth days or a fortnight of darkness. And yes, unless you specifically design to survive the lunar night, it gets extremely cold. It goes down to about minus 150 Celsius. And battery chemistry doesn't like that. And so batteries are not designed to essentially accept, to work again after that. As you mentioned with the JAXA SLIM mission, it isn't impossible. We will be listening once the sun comes back up on the site, but it wasn't a part of the mission design. If you do want to design a mission, which is something we do think about, if customers want to operate for multiple days, then you have to design that into your system, which at the simplest level is allowing some of your payload mass to be extra batteries that can provide heat during the night. But again, if you do that, then that's payload mass not being given to science payload. So you don't do that unless some of the payloads want to survive the night.
Now, IM-2 is still currently scheduled for launch later this year. How will it differ from IM-1, or is it essentially the same but, you know, more so?
Yeah, it's really the same but more so. So all three of our first missions use the Nova-C lander, which is essentially the same lander. And that's great because it means for IM-2, we learned a lot with IM-1 on operations. And one of the key technologies in IM-1 is the engine itself, which is we had developed a cryogenic liquid oxygen, liquid methane engine that worked incredibly well. It allows us to get to the moon in only 5 days. So IM-2 will use that same engine that we fired 6 times in IM-1. We now have a very good handle on its capabilities and how to maximize using that. The difference is it's actually going to land even closer to the South Pole, within about 1 degree latitude of the South Pole. You know, it's a slightly more challenging terrain, partly because as you get that close to the pole, the sun is very close to the horizon. So you're lighting, just like if you leave a torch lying on the floor, lying horizontal, all those long shadows look quite scary. And so, yeah, that small toy that looks like a mountain is just because the light is horizontal. So, yeah, it's the same, essentially the same lander, which we're very comfortable with.
It's very, you know, you talked about the terrain. I remember talking to Frank Borman about this. He name dropped. and just how when they went round the moon on Apollo 8, so seeing that far side of the moon for the first time, he just was taken by how broken up it was, how irregular it was. And that poses all those challenges for landing there, particularly when you're close and you think, oh my God, there's a crater there.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The good news is that now, thanks to NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, as well as some of the international, like the JAXA, the Japanese orbiter as well, we have some really good data sets which provide images, as well as slopes are also incredibly important to understand for picking a safe landing site. You would like it to be as flat as possible. Bizarrely, boulders are not a problem like most people would think of. Boulders are actually quite rare on the moon because they get broken down by micrometeorite impact over time. So it's not hard to avoid a region with lots of boulders. Your biggest problem is to look at slopes and craters. But again, we have very good imagery now to try and find safe landing sites over the ellipse of our landing area.
Now, you mentioned a bit earlier that, you know, you've spent a large part of your career working on the moon, and you mentioned lunar reconnaissance there, and you worked on that mission on one of the instruments, radio frequency, is that right? The radar instruments?
Yes.
And you've also worked on the Clementine Atlas. So you've been interested, haven't you, for a long time in terms of not just the moon, but its structure, its topology. And, you know, what is it about the moon that sort of grabbed you from such an early stage in your career?
I think as a teenager, though, I just naturally had an interest in human spaceflight. I would watch the Apollo documentaries. And like all teenagers, I would think, oh, I'd like to do that. And so always had an interest in human spaceflight and always had a fondness for the moon as our nearest neighbor. And all, as I would like to see us exploring the solar system. I was born after Apollo 11, just. And so I really would like to see us doing things in space that we regard as science fiction. And so I've been very fortunate in that to be able to pursue as a career something that I enjoy. I don't forget the fact that we're very lucky to do what we do and get paid.
I was born after Apollo 11 just as well. And it's something about having people doing it, isn't there? I mean, I know we can live through these robots doing it, but this is to lead up to people going to the moon. It must feel pretty exciting to be part of
And
of
part
that.
Of the commercial part of it. You know, you're not retreading things here. You're taking things on.
Sort of yes to both of those, in that I do think there's a role for both humans and robotic exploration. There are certain tasks that, it, you know, as we learn from Apollo and when we go back as part of Artemis, you're always going to have more things that you want to do than you have person time to be able to do them. So there will always be tasks that you should use a robot for instead of a human. Also, there are always going to be robots will always extend the reach of humans, even on the moon, if they want to go further away from their base camp. Or I'll give you an example. On IM-2, one of the things we're flying is a hopper that we have developed as part of a NASA technology program. And so this hopper, which looks like a mini lander, it's about a meter tall, it gets delivered to the lunar surface by our Nova C lander. And it can carry about 8 kilograms of payload and fly about 25 kilometers. And I'm extremely excited to see this fly because we will be able to travel faster and go to locations that rovers can't. Even on this first test flight of the hopper, we're actually going to do multiple hops, including flying into a permanently shadowed crater near the landing site, taking some data and then flying back out.
I hope this hopper has a head torch then.
It does. So actually, it does. No, well, funny you should say that. It does actually have an LED. No Bluetooth audio, but it does have a light. But funnily enough, one of the other projects I work on is there's a NASA instrument based out of Arizona State called ShadowCam that's flying on a Korean lunar orbiter right now. Think of this as a very sensitive camera that looks inside permanently shadowed craters. So permanently shadowed craters near the poles, they never see the sun. So there's no direct illumination, but the inner wall of the crater gets illuminated and that reflects down. So there's what we call secondary illumination. And so what ShadowCam has done is taken 2 meter data actually inside these permanently shadowed craters. And people on that team have done a calculation. There was a presentation at a science conference only last week where they showed that you could, in fact, walk around inside permanently shadowed craters as a human without a torch, because it will be quite bright.
That's brilliant. That's the sort of science I want to see done. I mean, just finally, it must be tremendously exciting to be involved in these projects. I know things get delayed, but there is a timeline here of things happening and leading towards humans going back to the moon, some sort of semi-permanent habitation on the moon, maybe. You know, it seems we're back on track.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so, you know, obviously we flew in February, we fly again at the end of the year, we're flying again next year. There are other CLIPS companies flying. The goal for CLIPS is to have 2 flights a year to the moon. And I think that's exciting for multiple reasons. First is there's going to be so much energy because we're going to keep on having missions. The second thing is we're going to find new things. We always do when we explore. And I'm excited by, with such a regular cadence, how much are we going to discover? And the other benefit is because we're going to keep on going, we're going to be able to make use of what we find. In typical NASA missions, you might go to a location once a decade. If you know you can go every year, you can do more bite-sized chunks. You can learn something and say, because of that, we're going to do it this way. And in fact, we'll do that in 3 years' time and we'll keep learning and we'll keep improving capabilities and what we find.
And will the company be involved in the lunar infrastructure that's going to be required, particularly for the far side? I'm thinking of relay satellites. Or will you depend on others?
No, so actually the communication relay, that's a very good example. That's one of the things that we've chosen to take responsibility for ourselves. And starting next year, we're going to start to put up our own communication relay satellites around the moon. That, you know, as a service for anyone, including us, to use, which obviously you need for far side missions. For things like lunar infrastructure on the surface, I think the one good thing about commercial is we will compete with other companies to try and do that. If NASA wants, you know, a cell tower put up at the pole to provide communications, or a small power station, you know, a big solar array that can provide power to multiple users, that's the exciting thing about a base camp in infrastructure. A perfect analogy, I think, is McMurdo in Antarctica. Because of the US McMurdo base, that piece of infrastructure enables scientific exploration of the entire Antarctic continent by US research teams, and just like the UK sites too. If you didn't have the infrastructure on the coast, you wouldn't get nearly as much exploration of Antarctica. And I think getting that foothold on the moon and the infrastructure, so services that is too big for a single mission but can be used multiple times, is key to go back to the science fiction idea that we really will be exploring long term.
I was going to mention one of our other guests that's on this podcast that you don't know yet is from Goonhilly Earth Station, works there in Cornwall. Did you ever imagine that, you know, this county that you come from, right the end of the UK, was going to be so much a part of the future return to the moon?
Yeah, I mean, Goonhilly, it's more than just a school trip. I've been thrilled that, you know, Goonhilly is one of our ground stations that we use to bring the data back from around the world. And I'm assuming that's Matt that you're talking to.
It is Matt Cosby, yes. We love Matt Cosby.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. And we just wish you all the best with the next mission.
Yeah,
thank you.
Sounds great.
Hopefully I'll talk to you again after that.
We'd love that. We'd love to have you back. Dr. Ben Bussey, Chief Scientist for Intuitive Machines.
And what a great guest. We will definitely have him back.
Fabulous guy. Very impressed with him.
This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists. Do get in touch on Facebook or X or, well, we're not going to mention the whole Instagram debacle, which we will try and sort out. We should, though, just quickly mention the sad loss of two more NASA pioneers, astronaut Tom Stafford. He flew Gemini 6, Gemini 9, Apollo 10 and commanded the historic Apollo-Soyuz mission of 1975. And also George Abbey, who oversaw a crew selection for the space shuttle in the 1980s. Quite a controversial figure, actually, when you read about George Abbey. He included in his work selecting Sally Ride as the first American woman in space. I have to say...
Have you met either of them? Because I haven't. I can't remember whether you had or not.
Exchanged emails with Tom Stafford with a view to interviewing him, but that never kind of make that work.
One that got away.
It was very much the one that got away. George Abbey, though, I have met and I have interviewed. He was delightful.
Where did you meet him then?
I met him in Houston.
All right.
So that would be back in 2019 when I was recording loads of programmes for the BBC and our space race.
Pre the desert era.
Yeah, and space race. So he was delightful. He also made a point to highlight the work, because he was involved in the Apollo programme as well. I mean, he really is, you know, quite instrumental in Apollo through into the shuttle era. He was very keen to mention the Brits who had been recruited for the Apollo programme.
Oh, I remember you talking to me about that. Oh, that was who you were writing. Oh,
yeah, yeah. So he was great. And he also very kindly showed me where Starbucks was. It was so confusing. So you know what Houston's like? It's all roads.
You listen to this podcast for quality material.
You can't walk anywhere in Houston around that area. And I couldn't figure out how to get to Starbucks because it was sort of over the other side of the freeway or something. And so they kindly drove and I followed him in my car and we waved goodbye. So that was the last I saw of George Abbey. But he was great. He was delighted. And in fact, maybe I'll dig out that, try and find that interview, which must be somewhere.
Oh, yes.
Somewhere in the archive somewhere. We'll try and put that
in
the future.
We've not used it on Space Boffins, though, have we?
No, we haven't.
Oh,
no,
excellent. Well, that would be a lovely thing for next time.
See if I can find that. Yeah.
Well, as we know, the Artemis missions will see astronauts return to the moon, specifically to explore the South Polar region, where there might be frozen water ice, which could be used for a moon base and to produce fuel. But as we mentioned with Ben, the sun at the lunar South Pole hovers just above the horizon. So although there are regions of sustained sunlight, many areas of the craters are in near permanent darkness. And that means you can't use solar power for energy and will need an alternative energy source, particularly for those long lunar nights.
Well, a number of countries are therefore exploring nuclear power in the form of micro reactors for the moon. You may have seen this story, China and Russia recently announcing they're working together on building a reactor, although a lot of things that they announce don't often happen. But the US and Europe have also been looking into a nuclear power solution. And last year, the UK Space Agency funded Rolls-Royce just short of £3 million to deliver an initial demonstration of a modular nuclear reactor for the moon.
Well, at the recent Spacecom Expo in Farnborough, I met up with the chief engineer for Novel Nuclear. I love that title, Novel Nuclear at Rolls-Royce, Jake Thompson, and began by suggesting that most people might associate Rolls-Royce with cars and jet engines instead of nuclear power.
Well, for more than 60 years, Rolls-Royce has quietly been designing, manufacturing and supporting all of the nuclear reactors for the Royal Navy submarines. So we have a vast heritage of providing very small, very compact nuclear reactors. So we're bringing that capability into these really exciting new domains like space exploration.
That is quite cool. Do you have an idea then, at this moment in time, of what these small nuclear reactors will look like, or how you're going to engineer them, or are you starting from scratch?
No, we've been working on these concepts now for about the last 4 years. So we've had some really fantastic support through the UK Space Agency to help fund this development. We're now in the concept development phase, and we're building some prototype components, and we're doing testing on those components. So we've got a pretty good idea of what these systems are going to look like, and crucially for space, how much they're going to weigh.
Exactly. So give us an idea of the sort of size, weight, and what source of radioactivity you're likely to use.
These are fission-based reactor systems, so they will use a form of low-enriched uranium. So we use high-assay low-enriched uranium, enriched to around 19%. So that's the kind of fuel. In terms of physical size, they're roughly about the size of a small family car and a few tons in weight. So for a nuclear reactor, absolutely tiny. For a space system, they're still relatively large.
Yeah, so how would you, you know, looking ahead in the future, how would you envisage getting this of that weight? You know, would it be one per mission, or would it be modular? Could you take it up in different parts and reassemble it on the moon?
There are a couple of options to do that. The easiest option is to launch it as a single system and integrate into a lander and land on the lunar surface and then essentially plug the reactor into your moon base. That's probably the easiest, but it requires a large lander to do that. There are a couple of companies looking at really large landers at the moment, so that option looks very feasible. Or there are other options where you could send it up in the modular fashion and assemble it on the lunar surface. But that comes with other complications of, you know, actually assembling something on a lunar surface, or at least connecting two modules together.
And with a nuclear reactor of that size, like you say, the size of an SUV, how much power would you get from it, and how long would it last?
In terms of power, we're looking at kind of tens to hundreds of kilowatts. And in terms of its longevity, that could be always on power for at least a decade.
Wow, so that is impressive. And in terms of what that could power, if there was a lunar base, which is what the eventual plans are, how many of these reactors would you need to service the needs of a base with obviously living facilities and power for instrumentation, etc.?
It's entirely scalable. So these systems are kind of in the 50 to 100 kilowatts each. We can scale up to bigger systems, so it really depends on the needs of the architecture and the infrastructure that's on the lunar surface. But we'd envisage, you know, a microgrid with a few of these reactors, supplemented as well with solar power. At the South Pole, the sun does come up a little bit, so you can use some solar power, and then have baseload provided by a small microgrid of these nuclear reactors.
And you're working with a number of other organisations and universities as well. What is the sort of input from each of them? Bearing in mind you've got, as you've said, quite a lot of expertise in these sort of reactors, albeit for nuclear submarines.
It's a model we use across Rolls-Royce, really working with a network of research centres and academic institutions across the UK to provide kind of deep technical expertise and to provide facilities to do some early stage testing in. So we're working with several of these institutions on our current UK Space Agency contract, and they're helping us to develop heat exchanger technology and do testing in kind of coolant flows and validate some of our computer models. We're also doing testing and development of the fuel itself with an academic institution, and some of the research institutions are helping to develop the manufacturing techniques that we need to actually build these reactors.
And in terms of what is already available at the moment, doesn't sound like you're reinventing the wheel. It just sounds like you're adapting and innovating existing technology. Does this mean that you have competition from around the world?
There's always competition. And the technology itself, it's a bit of both. So some of the technology is very high TRL and it's deployed.
TRL?
Sorry, technology readiness level.
Thank you.
So some of the technology is already in use today. Some of it is more novel and we're developing systems that haven't been used before. And the real challenge is integrating all of those different technology building blocks into a whole system that works. And that's what we've got real expertise at Rolls-Royce from our submarine and aerospace heritage. You asked about competition. There are other companies and other countries looking at this technology, and we're looking at collaborative models of how we work that, how we can work those relationships to really make sure that as a human race we support exploration to the lunar surface and really deploy this technology as soon as we can.
Being a journalist, I'm going to have to ask you the doom and gloom question. As you'll know, the most dangerous part of any mission is the launch. what would happen, heaven forbid, if there was a launch of one of these prototype reactors, or by then it wouldn't be a prototype, we'd know that it worked, and the launcher blew up on its way up into the atmosphere when you've got this material on board? How would you sort of mitigate against that?
That's not a doom and gloom question. These are the engineering challenges that we work through every day, because we would only deploy a system when we have convinced ourselves that that system is safe in every aspect of its life cycle, including launch, which can be a very dynamic event.
That's an understatement, that phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you. In terms of the nuclear safety aspects during a launch sequence event or a launch sequence accident, the reactor is only designed to be turned on when it actually gets to the lunar surface, gets to its final destination. And before the reactor is turned on, the nuclear fuel inside the reactor is inert, and it's perfectly safe to handle and touch, and it's not radioactive until that reactor's been turned on. So during a launch event, the reactor itself is like any other piece of hardware on that rocket in terms of risk to humans, risk to the environment, you know, that kind of thing. So it only becomes radioactive when you turn it on, when it's in place on the lunar surface.
So the stage we're at now, when do you hope to have a working prototype?
The ambitious target is to deploy a nuclear reactor to the lunar surface in the early 30s. And there's a few steps to get to there, but we hope to have a working prototype and test reactor on Earth before that, in the late 20s, and then have one of these reactors on the surface of the moon, powering a moon base in the early 30s.
Jake Thompson from Rolls-Royce, and thanks to the UK Space Agency for supporting the podcast, which helped pay my train fare to Farnborough.
I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't use modular nuclear reactors. And he explains the safety case pretty clearly, I thought, in that interview. I mean, they've been in nuclear submarines since the 1950s.
Yes. And they've been on, there was a mini sort of nuclear power source, effectively, on Apollo 12. That was the first, you could say that's the first reactor on the moon, although it was only a little cylindrical device. It was only about 14 by 16 inches, sort of 45 centimetres-ish, 38. And Apollo 11 also used a sort of radioactive isotope.
So they're nuclear batteries, really,
yeah,
aren't they, rather than a reactor as such?
Yeah, that was to heat. The Apollo 11 one was to keep, basically, you use the, as the isotope decays, you get heat from that, and then that keeps the instruments at a working temperature, because otherwise you can't.
Yeah.
But you did. But on Apollo 12, it was a battery. Yeah, but they like to call it a micro reactor because it was using decay of nuclear isotope, plutonium in that case, to produce heat, and then they use that heat in Apollo 12 for electricity to actually power the instrument package.
Yeah, so, and there are those nuclear batteries on Mars and on Voyager as well.
A lot of the deep space missions.
But this would be a reactor, so it would be slightly different. It would be like in a nuclear submarine. It would be a reactor, controlled reactor,
and it's
fuel rods and the like.
It's so interesting, and I've been doing quite a bit of research on this because I'm also writing something for BBC Future on it as well. Purely from that Rolls-Royce interview, Jake, what a great communicator he is, and obviously really enthused about his job. But it was after speaking to him that I thought this is fascinating. I love this. So. And also the benefits will be on Earth too, as sort of has been gone into. We can't keep using fossil fuels. Nuclear is carbon free. The technology has improved, but I think most people still do associate it with disasters. And I think we've got to get away from that mindset and look forward. And I like the way here we've got something that's of benefit for both space travel. Well, it's always been used, it's often been used a long time for space travel, but potential moon base and also on Earth as well for better, cleaner energy.
And don't get me wrong, I think this is a great idea, but I can't help thinking Space 1999.
Well,
when there was a nuclear dump on the moon and the explosion, it knocked it out into the...
Have you been reading my piece?
I started writing it today. Nuclear on the moon, Space 1999.
It's the obvious one for people like us and our age as well, but I started off, as is often the case when you're writing articles, and I don't know, you feel the same. You can spend 2 hours going,
Oh, no, Space 1999 is the obvious way in.
Oh, no, I tried different ways of going in, all different aspects, and I kept coming back to Space 1999. In the end, I thought, sod it. I'm starting with Space 1999. That's got to be it. So that is actually how I've started.
Yeah.
I should have just got you to write it for me.
Yeah. I mean,
I hate this. It's obvious. How dare you? It's not obvious. It's not obvious to a 20-year-old.
It's not obvious to a 30-year-old. No, it wouldn't be obvious
Probably
at all.
Maybe not even to a 40-year-old.
No.
Because that series went out in the
1970s. Yeah.
1975. Yeah. And I know Elon Musk
has,
you know, said he wanted to call his moon base Alpha, but which may have made a few people go to Google and suddenly discover it. But I think only people, space boffins, listeners of a certain vintage.
I think I saw the repeats though.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I don't think I saw it when it first went out.
Well, as you heard, while talking to Intuitive Machines' Ben Bussey, who's originally from Cornwall, as we know, we mentioned the Goon Hilly Earth Station there. And it has an impressive track record, as we'll hear. And just a couple of years ago, in 2021, it also became the world's first private deep space communications network. Understandably, Goon Hilly had a presence at the big UK space industry event that is Spacecom Expo. So I caught up with their Chief Technology Officer Matt Cosby to hear more about their recent work with the IM-1 mission.
We were tracking the vehicle all the way from launch, so we picked it up about 10 hours after launch once it came over the horizon. We followed it all through the cruise stages, through all its trajectory burns, its critical manoeuvres, its lunar insertion, and all the way down to the surface. So we were the prime station for when it landed on the moon. So we had the pleasure of telling Intuitive Machines that they'd landed and the signal was being received from the spacecraft on the surface of the moon.
That's pretty cool. But then Goon Hilly has got a little bit of quite a good history at this sort of thing, hasn't it?
Yeah, we were built for Telstar back in 1962. So that was the first transatlantic TV pictures from the US. Then, of course, Apollo, we were used to broadcast the signal across the world. So we received the signal from the Early Bird, which was the very first geostationary satellite, and then that was broadcast back to London, which was then broadcast to billions of people around Europe.
Now, it's been a few years since Space Boffins has been to Goon Hilly, so update me in terms of what's been going on since then and where are you now?
Okay, so we have been building our capabilities so we can support the moon. I know the moon is a big focus at the moment, but what we've been doing is the antenna has been upgraded to be able to support lunar missions. But because everything talks the same language, it all follows the standards, space standards, which the UK is great at the moment, we can support other missions. So we've been supporting Mars Express, we supported Chandrayaan 3, which landed on the moon. We're regularly supporting the ISRO, the Indian mission, solar mission, Aditya L1, which is currently at Lagrange 1 at the moment. We do that every day. Although we're focusing on the moon, we're generating business through supporting these other missions.
Now, your antenna that's on site, it's quite impressive when you're actually there because there's just so many of them. They do range from what I can politely call the vintage to the more recent ones. Have you had to upgrade any of your antenna in order to cope with this sort of increasing traffic to the moon and its surrounding orbits and environment?
Yes, so all the antennas were built for an original job, and then things move on, technology moves on. So you then have to repurpose. So the antenna that we've used for the moon, we've completely repurposed. So it's a different frequency range, different antenna. We've actually ripped out everything from the gearboxes, motors, modems, up converters, down converters, all the equipment, even the floor we replaced. So we replaced everything except the actual antenna itself. We even replaced all the bolts on the backing structure. So there was about 7,000 bolts, took 7 months for a shift of for 7 months, constantly replacing all those bolts. So yeah, we do upgrade and we do repurpose. We bought a company in the US that's got antennas as well. We plan to build out the capability to have more lunar capability. So when the moon goes round the Earth, we can see it at different locations around the Earth.
So which lunar missions are you supporting in the near future?
We've signed Intuitive Machines for their previous mission, but also their next three missions. So we were supporting their next lander, which should be going by the end of this year or early next. That's a few other missions on it, which we can't announce at the moment. But then their next mission will also have an orbiter on as well, so we'll be supporting them. So one of the things that in the early lunar going back to the moon is that they're all short-lived missions. They're two-week missions. They're only the lunar day. The goal is to survive the lunar night. And once we can survive the lunar night, then the missions will increase and we'll have more comms coming from the moon. And the more comms is better for us.
Does the fact that the recent lander for the Japanese SLIM mission, which did survive lunar night, which, you know, a lot of people were like, oh my goodness, does that bring future capabilities, or was that a one-off, do you think?
We're all conservative people, you know, we've got margin on margin, so we don't want to say that we can survive the night, but I think everybody wants to survive the night. They don't design for surviving the night, but they really want to do it. And I think the SLIM showed that you can do it, and hopefully Intuitive can also survive the night. So they're not putting that down as a milestone, but they want to survive the night. So actually we are going to be, come the 17th of March, we're going to be watching the moon and looking out for that signal, so see if it survived the night. But yeah, that is the key. Once you get past that, surviving the two Earth weeks at night in that cold, harsh environment, that's the key, and that's going to get us the continuous presence on the moon.
So by this 17th of March date, if it survived, it will have survived two lunar nights, is that right?
No, it would have survived, for SLIM. Yeah, SLIM would have survived two lunar nights, but this is for Intuitive Machines. We want to see if it can survive the night. So that'll be the first time that the sun will come up in that location. The way it landed, actually, there's a solar panel that was supposed to be on the top, but it was lying on its side. That solar panel is pointing to where the sun will come up. So we've estimated that that's the time that we will first see the signals.
That's quite exciting.
It is quite exciting, But they're quietly confident, but they're not going to say we designed it to survive the night, because they haven't. But their ambition is to survive the night. And once you get that surviving the night, that's going to be key to see, as I said, the sustainable presence on the moon.
If that signal happens, will the champagne be out then at Goonhilly?
It was very British, sort of jumping up and sort of clapping and then going for a cup of tea. There wasn't, because we were watching the signal go down, and then we knew that we would lose the signal as it came down because of the orientation of the spacecraft. And then it landed, and the timer went from zero and started going positive, so we knew it landed. And then we were scouring the surface for the signal, and it was like we knew that people all around the world were watching, going, okay. They're watching, waiting for the signal, and I'm going, yes, I know, we're looking for that signal. And seeing that signal trace across the spectrum analyzer was just a relief. So I didn't get to do the jumping up and down bit. It was just like, there it is, tell them it's there. That was the exciting bit.
Oh, good. So not even maybe when you went home, a little beer or something?
No, because we then, because it was landing on its side, the signal wasn't strong, so we spent quite a significant amount of time trying to peak up the signal. And what we did is because the moon throws back a lot of RF noise, radio frequency noise, it sort of raises our noise floor, as we say, so the signal gets hidden, and it's like a whisper in a crowded room. So what we did is move the antenna off the moon, because it was in the South Pole. We were trying to get lower noise from the moon but get that signal through. So once we did that, we actually started getting data through, and that took about 3 to 4 hours to get to that point. So in our time, it was like 3 or 4 in the morning. And then I had to get up and do a BBC interview. And it was like...
oh, no.
So, no,
I
there was
feel,
no time
yeah,
for that.
Yeah.
Oh. Once it was put to sleep and it was ready to come back after, now we're in the stage where it's sleeping, that was the time for celebration.
Goonhilly Earth Station's Matt Cosby. And you heard a reference to the 17th of March there, seeing if IM-1 would survive the night, because obviously that interview was recorded just before that point. And as you will hopefully or may well know now, that it didn't call home, but slim chances of that happening anyway. But what a success for IM-1, and also for Goonhilly to be involved in the first US mission to soft land on the moon in over 50 years.
And that's it for this month's Space Boffins. We'll be in Pennsylvania or thereabouts to see the eclipse. or at least to see the sky go dark.
Yeah, it wasn't planned that way. Let's just say that. We were originally going somewhere with perhaps a better weather forecast. But
you're saying Pennsylvania wasn't our first choice.
Well, it's only in like the northwestern tip. But it's because our lovely son is doing a PhD in Pennsylvania, so that's where we're going to see it from. So who knows? Maybe Texas will have, you know, a terrible, terrible weather, and the only place to see it will be that northwestern tip of Pennsylvania in April.
It'll be a fun party.
It will.
Yeah. So do say hello if you see some random Brits in Space Boffins t-shirts in Erie or nearby. And
We're not entirely sure where.
We've booked a hotel somewhere near. We'll head vaguely in that direction and see how far we get. It's a well thought out plan.
I have a feeling it's not going to be like the Oregon one in 2018.
Yeah, that was Cornwallis.
Yeah. But who knows? I think it's going to be packed full of people anyway across.
Big great event.
And of course, the USA is so lucky to have two within a matter of years. Anyway, we're looking forward to it. So yeah, do say hi if you see us. And get in touch on Facebook or X or email in the meantime, podcast@spaceboffins.com. And thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.